Hi, everyone. This is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. Welcome back to the Structural Heart Talks podcast. Our guest today is Larry Wood. Larry is Corporate Vice President and Group President of Transcatheter Aortic Valve Replacement and Surgical Structural Heart at Edwards Lifesciences. Larry and I connected a couple of years ago when we were discussing the 10th anniversary of the approval of SAPIEN, which of course is a revolutionary heart valve replacement. And I'll include the link to that podcast that we had on Device Talks Weekly, because it really sort of set the stage for this conversation, where we talked extensively about Edwards' recent clinical trial, Early TAVR, that's really examining how you can use, or how TAVR should be used on patients even earlier in the progression of severe aortic stenosis. So it's an effort undertaken by Edwards to really get a treatment to the patients who need it. It's been working with the FDA on the trial. We'll talk about the results that were released at the recent TCT meeting and what this means for TAVR going forward. So thanks very much to Larry Wood for taking the time to reconnect and to talk about the great work at Edwards. But before we begin this conversation, I want to bring in a message from our sponsor, Confluent Medical.
All right, well, before we begin this episode, I want to bring in our sponsor, Confluent Medical. I'm here with Tom Ditter. He's Senior Director of Product Development at Confluent Medical. Tom, Confluent's made quite a bit of noise in the medical device space this year, specifically surrounding Nitinol, which has been just really an exciting topic of the year and of the past couple of years. Before the company was Confluent, it was known as NDC, which stands for Nitinol Devices and Components. Can you give us a quick overview of how Confluent got to where it is today and how your history is connected to NDC and to Nitinol?
Yes, you know, before it was called Nitinol Devices and Components, it was actually known as Nitinol Development Corporation. And the philosophy of the founders was to understand the fundamental material science behind Nitinol and to use that to design and process components made from Nitinol. Now, Confluent continues its legacy today throughout its capabilities. It focuses on the material science of not just Nitinol, but also polymers and textiles as well.
That's really interesting. And as a contract manufacturer, your job is to assist OEMs in taking a design from prototype to production. Can you give us some examples of how Confluent accomplished this recently? A few cases you've worked on. I know you have to probably be sparse on details, but what are some of the things you've been working on?
Confluent is fully integrated. It has the capability to take a product from prototyping to development, optimization, and full-scale manufacturing. We recently just worked with a OEM on a novel neurovascular stent. We assisted them in initial design iterations, process development, to full-blown manufacturing.
Tom, Confluent Medical is a contract manufacturer, which means you assist OEMs in taking design from prototype to production. Can you give us an example of how Confluent has recently accomplished this?
Yes, as you mentioned, Confluent is fully integrated. We do have the capability to take a product from initial prototyping to full-scale manufacturing. We recently accomplished this with a OEM that was working on a novel neurovascular stent. We worked with them on the initial design iterations, took it to process, development, optimization, and finally to full-scale manufacturing.
Well, Larry Wood, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
Good to have you back. We had you on Device Talks Weekly a couple of years ago. This was 2021. I think we were talking about the 10th anniversary of SAPIEN's FDA approval and commercial availability. And I'll put a link to that episode in the show notes, because I think it was just it's a good precursor to this conversation, but it's also, I think, kind of a masterclass on bringing innovative technologies to the market. Lots of points of wisdom in there, and I really enjoyed re-listening to that. But within that podcast was your story of how you got into medtech. I don't want to go through the entire thing again, but it's a unique story in that you sort of came to the medtech industry after, I believe you started your career in welding and learned quickly that you didn't want to do that your entire life, so you found your way to the medical device industry. If you would just quickly share with our listeners of this podcast how you found your way to MedTech and ultimately to Edwards.
Yeah, no, I'm very fortunate. I was working as a welder and did realize that wasn't something I wanted to do. And I went to a job fair and I got a job as an assembler working on the manufacturing line, and you know, kind of thought it would be a summer job. And next summer will be my 40th summer. It'll be 40 years at Edwards. So it's been quite a journey. But I think it speaks to Edwards that I was able to kind of grow up in the company. I started in ops. I moved through quality. I did regulatory and clinical, and then eventually went into marketing and then general management, and really started running THB from inception. And I'm still here today, you know, running the business that we created, over 20 years ago. And some of my original team still with me, which is just remarkable. And that's what's made the journey so fun is, you know, the technology and the patients certainly, but the team and the people I've been able to work with all this time and the physicians, it's just been an incredible community of people who really care deeply about patients and science and doing things the right way. And it's just made just such a rewarding journey. And I think so many people really work hard in their life. And I'd like to think that I work really hard too, but I think it's a lot easier to work really hard when you get to see the value of your work in patients.
How blessed do you feel that to have been part of the Sapien story? I mean, I think probably once every 10 years, there's really a technology that changes the medical world, and Sapien would certainly qualify as one in the whole TAVR field. Do you, I imagine you count yourself lucky every day.
I really do. And, you know, outside of my daughters, it's been the greatest gift to be able to be a part of this and be on this journey and to take a technology that no one thought would work and then to have it be, you know, really the standard of care. And now, actually enable us to challenge the fundamental way we think about the disease. It's a once in a lifetime opportunity. I mean, I don't even know things like this come along every 10 years. I think people ask me all the time, what's the next TAVR? And I'm like, I don't know, but it won't be something I get to do because you only get to do these once in a lifetime. And most people never even get that opportunity. So I am grateful every single day for the opportunity that I've had to just be a part of this.
That's fantastic. If you would, just take a minute to introduce folks who may not know, you know, what is TAVR? How is Sapien a part? What are the offerings that Edwards have? Give us an overview of the TAVR space from Edwards' perspective.
Sure. Well, TAVR, basically, the concept was, could we replace someone's aortic heart valve without open heart surgery? And, you know, the traditional standard of care has been the traditional sternotomy, putting a patient on the heart-lung machine, cutting out their old valve and removing all the disease and all the calcium, and then sewing in a new valve that we manufacture. And we make those as well, and I'm responsible for that business as well. And it's an incredible procedure. It's incredibly safe. It works incredibly well. But it is about the most invasive thing you can do to the human body. And if people are young and healthy, they get through it pretty well. They have, you know, 3 to 6 months recovery time. But for people that are older or frail, and there's a lot of people who just, especially older people, who just say, I'm not going to subject myself to that invasiveness. Mm-hmm. And TAVR gave us the opportunity to make a small incision in the groin, about a half an inch, and we can do the procedure with catheters under basically what amounts to x-ray visualization, fluoroscopy, and we can deliver the valve. And the procedure's evolved to a point now where we can do it in about 30 minutes, and we don't actually even put people to sleep. They're under just what we call conscious sedation, kind of like if you were undergoing a colonoscopy or something like that. And so the patients are actually awake. You can actually talk to them and they have their procedure, and the majority of patients go home the next day and they return to their, you know, regular quality of life. One of our patients was skiing in a week. It's amazing what people are able to do.
You wouldn't think someone who was undergoing this procedure would be in a position to ski. I think you always have in mind that they're older and more feeble and just kind of need help remaining alive, for lack of a better word, as opposed to living a full life.
I think that's one of the things that we learned. It was super valuable is when a patient underwent open heart surgery, we fixed the disease, but we did all of this collateral damage. Mm-hmm. And so what they were recovering from wasn't the long recovery from this historic heart disease they've had. It's the recovery from the procedure itself. When we had the ability to go in and just fix the valve and not do any collateral damage, it created this amazing opportunity for us to see the benefits of our work, you know, really immediately. People feel better that day. And if they walked into the hospital, they will walk home the same way. And it's an amazing procedure that way. And that's kind of one of the things we've learned as well is a lot of patients that have surgery, they're not able to go home. They have to go to an assisted living center or a step-down facility, or they need care. But our patients, you know, I think it's something like 96% of them go home. They go home to the home they came from. And elderly patients, that's probably one of the things they live most in fear of, is being dependent on other people. And their independence is critically important to them. And that's what, frankly, makes a lot of people walk away from surgery as an option. They're worried they won't be able to care for themselves, and they don't want to be a burden to their family. And that's where this procedure can really become a godsend for them.
And when we spoke last, you talked about how the valves themselves have evolved. And you would look at the, I think you said looking at the first valve today would be like the Wright brothers, you know, or looking, having the Wright brothers looking at a 747 today would be just amazed at the advances in aeronautics and in airplanes. Talk, if you would, just a bit about your portfolio, about what you have for the TAVR space and how it's progressed.
Sure. It's been an amazing technology journey. When we started the procedure, the device profile, basically how large the device is, really limited the patients that could get the procedure through the groin. Only about half of patients were able to get it that way. The other half actually had to have surgery, where we did a very minimally invasive surgery. They didn't have to go on the heart-lung machine, but we made a cut between their ribs and we hit the heart directly that way. But we learned that procedure just wasn't as good. It was still surgery, and it was still invasive, especially for sicker, frailer people. So the number one thing we did was we had to get the profile down. We had to make the device smaller, narrow profile. So we did that with the next generation of product. And then the next challenge that we had was sometimes you saw blood leakage around the valve. And what that was caused by was the native valve, all the diseased tissue, is very irregular. And so it was hard to get good apposition from the transcatheter heart valve to the annulus. So we were able to put a skirt on the valve. And by using that cloth skirt, we were able to seal off that leakage. And so that made the procedure that much better. And all along the way, we've been continuing to study the valve in different patient populations that expanded the patients that would be eligible for the therapy. So we started in inoperable, we moved to high risk, we moved to intermediate risk, and then we eventually did low risk, and that was with our Sapien 3 platform. And the results were remarkable. The patients were, on average, 73 years old, and 99% of our patients were alive and well at 1 year, which was a remarkable achievement. Alive and well means they were alive and they hadn't had a disabling stroke or something that would really set them back. And so that was an incredible achievement, but that really is, physician education evolving and them becoming more advanced in their techniques, but also the technology enabling, you know, a procedure that would have only been a dream when we first started the therapy.
But despite all those advances, I think there was a bit of foreshadowing in the podcast we did previously where you had indicated that we're really scratching the surface, is my term, but we're treating a subpopulation of patients with severe aortic stenosis. So where do we stand today on treating this disease? How many people who need the care are getting the care?
Well, we still, undertreatment is still a massive problem. We only treat about 13 out of 100 patients with severe aortic stenosis.
Wow.
And one of the challenges to that has been, because surgery was the historical analog, clear back in like the 1960s, Dr. Bromwell created this Bromwell curve. Well, I sort of think of it almost as a risk-benefit curve, and it said that basically you wanted to wait until the disease had advanced to a severe state, but also for the patient to exhibit symptoms, and that was the proper time to intervene. So in a sense, you know, and we use the cancer analogy, I think we used that before, but, you know, cancer, you try to catch it at stage one or stage two, but aortic valve disease, we weren't even trying to catch it till stage four, and even at stage four, the patient actually had to physically feel bad. And I've always been skeptical of that. And a lot of physicians wanted to challenge it, but it's hard to challenge 60 years of dogma. And that's really what it was. And it drove all the guidelines and it drove all the treatment pathways for patients. And so you would have this weird world where a patient would get diagnosed with severe AS, but a doctor would sort of, I call it, you know, we do the track and field, which is the echo, and then we do Olympic figure skating. We apply all this judgment to the disease and decide whether to advance the patient or not. And what we were decided to do was embark on the trial we called Early TAVR, which we said, the severe disease should be enough, but we're going to randomize patients who are asymptomatic, and we're going to say half of them get the valve and half of them are going to get the traditional clinical surveillance, and we're going to see what's better, and we're going to do it definitively. And that's a trial that we just announced the results of at the last TCT meeting about a month ago.
So I want to explore that study in a moment, but it would help me to, what, when you say a patient feels bad, you know, what does that mean? What kind of symptoms are they showing? You know, are they just lethargic? Is it more discomfort than that? And I know there's going to be a range depending on the patients, but
sure.
Typically what is someone who's feeling bad but told that we're not going to necessarily be able to treat you? What are they feeling and how are they feeling?
Yeah, the first symptoms they start to see is probably fatigue. They can't walk as far as they used to. They get short of breath much easier. And those symptoms just gradually worsen. And this is one of the big challenges is because aortic stenosis tends to be a disease of the aging, of the elderly, a lot of times people just write that off to just aging. Sure, grandpa can't walk as far as he used to. He's 75 years old. Sure, he can't, you know, jog, or he can't ride a bike anymore. You know, he's 75. And people get caught up in that. What they don't realize is it's not their age. It's this progressive disease of aortic stenosis. And what's happening is their valve is getting narrower and narrower, and it's limiting the amount of forward blood flow. And so it's just not oxygenating their body the way that it used to. And so, and that's happening gradually, but it's also easy to mistake. Sometimes people mistake it for a respiratory condition. They think it might be asthma or COPD or something else. So a patient will come in with aortic stenosis and they'll give them an inhaler to try to improve their breathing or to try to do those things. And that's kind of how it progresses. But then it continues to get more progressive to where it's not feeling short of breath under exertion. It's short of breath all of the time. And they can feel chest pain and tightness. And then eventually they can suffer an episode of syncope where they actually, you know, faint or lose consciousness. And that can be very dangerous in elderly patients. Falls are a leading cause of death among the elderly. And certainly that's one of the things. Or people can just wake up in the middle of the night and say, I can't breathe. And then their family member takes them to the hospital and they go down that process. So it really is progressive. And the further you get down the progression, the more dangerous the condition becomes, leading up to sudden death.
All right, we'll take a quick break from this conversation to bring back our sponsor, Confluent Medical. I'm here with Tom Ditter. He is Senior Director of Product Development at Confluent Medical. Tom, nitinol is growing in popularity. We're seeing more and more OEMs are turning to it. This alloy has shape memory. It has super elastic properties. Can you explain how Confluent sets itself apart from other nitinol suppliers?
Well, Confluent has over 30 years of experience in the design and processing of nitinol. But beyond that expertise, Confluent identified a nitinol supply chain gap. They invested over $100 million across the supply chain. Most recently, they just made an investment of over $50 million in additional melt and conversion capacity, becoming the fulfillment partner for one of the largest melt suppliers in the industry.
So, Tom, we're hearing so much about nitinol's super elastic and shape memory properties. It makes it an ideal alloy, specifically within the neurovascular space. Can you speak to how Confluent's expertise is able to meet the growing demands for OEMs in the neurovascular market?
Yes, for neurovascular applications, durability is a major consideration, and Confluent Medical has invested heavily in the development and processing of high-purity alloys for increased durability and fatigue resistance. Our material SE508 ELI is one of the highest purity materials available and ideal for high-cycle fatigue applications, as found in neurovascular devices. Additionally, Confluent specializes in high-precision polymer tubing, such as FilmCast PTFE. This makes us unique in the neurovascular space in that we can offer PTFE with thinner walls and larger diameters, making it ideal for large diameter aspiration catheters.
So, Tom, that's super interesting about the neurovascular space. So what does the future look like for nitinol in the neurovascular device market?
The demand for minimally invasive procedures is growing, so we can expect to see nitinol as a key alloy for these devices. Future applications such as neurovascular devices will need to have a smaller profile with an emphasis on durability. Additionally, high purity nitinol is needed to address high fatigue applications to prevent fracture and improve longevity for patients.
Well, this has been really entertaining and insightful, Tom. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you, Tom. Glad to be with you.
And thanks to Confluent Medical for sponsoring this episode. If you'd like to find out more about Confluent Medical, go to confluentmedical.com or, interestingly enough, nitinol.com.
Let's talk about the study. What are its origins? When was it sort of conceived? And when did this all begin and why?
Yeah, well, as I talked, you know, we kind of had to earn the right to be able to study this sort of patient. You know, we, mm-hmm. you know, in the beginning, we were inoperable people, and we worked our way down to low-risk patients. So we had to prove that the technology was safe in a patient population that does very well with surgery. And we were able to do that and actually show that the procedure was at 1 year better than surgery for the primary endpoint. So that was really, really important. But that's what enabled us to go the next step, which is saying, should we wait for symptoms? So we were probably started having conversations about this probably over 8 years ago. Okay. And, you know, key clinicians, Philippe Genereau was very keen on this. Dr. Marty Leon was very keen on it. But we started discussing the real semantics of how would you run this trial? And could you get an asymptomatic patient to sign up for a trial? If, you know, if a patient doesn't feel bad, you know, are you going to get them to undergo a valve replacement procedure? And so mm-hmm. those were a lot of things that were challenging for us. The other thing I will say is, there was a strong belief system that a lot of these patients probably are symptomatic. The symptoms just aren't being identified. So how do you make sure you're only really getting asymptomatic patients into the trial? And those were a lot of the details that we had to work out. And it was pretty complicated because it's not a study that's ever really been done before in this way. And so we really were doing groundbreaking work in terms of how would you approach this and how would you do it.
So in the thesis of the study is if we treat these patients even before they're demonstrating symptoms, over the long haul, over the long run, they'll be healthier because of it, because we intervened early.
Yeah. Well, this was one of the complexities of the trial. We wanted to show that earlier treatment was better, but we weren't sure how it was going to manifest itself because the things that we didn't know if you subjected patients to a stress test, how many would truly be asymptomatic. We didn't know if everybody would fail a stress test or if everybody would pass a stress test. And we really didn't know. We had no idea. The second part about it is how fast would people progress? Do people progress very quickly or do they progress very slowly? If they progress very quickly, then that creates one sort of clinical benefit possibility. If they progress very slowly, then you need to look at other factors. So we had to design a trial that could show benefits in a number of different ways if there was any benefit to be had. And it wasn't, by no means was this a foregone conclusion that this trial would be successful.
Sure.
Nobody'd studied before, so there was real risk that we would show watchful waiting and clinical surveillance are a perfectly acceptable strategy. And we didn't know that going in. But the thing that we did know is we would be a lot smarter about how to treat this disease at the end of this trial than we were at the beginning of the trial. And we felt like the scientific community and the medical community and patients needed that information to really inform the patient decision.
Larry, this sounds like a complex clinical trial to recruit for. How did you get patients involved with this? What was the recruitment like? What was the process like?
8 years ago when we designed this trial, we were probably most focused on, could you enroll this trial at all? Could this trial even move forward in any way? And so the way we designed the trial was, all of the investigators basically had to reach out to their echo labs and say, we need you to send us your patients that have severe AS. And so they started doing that, and then the heart team would have to review the patient. And they would talk to them about the severe disease. They would educate them about the risks of the disease and talk to them about it. And then if a patient consented to be in the trial, the next step was they had to get a CT because we had to know that they would actually be eligible to get a transcatheter heart valve anatomically. And then the next step that they had to do was they had to undergo a protocolized stress test to confirm that they were truly asymptomatic. And we probably screened about 1,600 patients to find 900 that would meet all the trial criteria. And one of the things that we found was about one out of five people could not pass a stress test. So that means 20% of patients that were deemed asymptomatic truly were asymptomatic when they were subjected to a stress test, which means they were indicated for a valve replacement now, immediately. So they could move forward to treatment. Then we found some other patients that were simply not anatomically suitable, or after they went through the screening, decided they didn't want to participate in the trial or whatnot. And that's where we were left with the primary cohort of 900 patients. But they'd all been deemed eligible for transcatheter heart valve therapy, and they had all passed, or I think 90-some-odd percent of them had passed a stress test. There were some patients unable physically to undergo the stress test, So we used other screening tools to confirm they were asymptomatic. But you had well over 90% that had undergone the stress test. So we were very, very confident that we had a truly asymptomatic population. And then we randomized them. Half of the group at random got a transcatheter hard valve, and the other half got clinical surveillance. And clinical surveillance basically says you're in the office, you've had your review with your physician, you're not indicated for valve replacement, so come back in 6 months to a year, which is what the guidelines say, and we'll do a follow-up visit, and we'll see if you've become asymptomatic by then. And so that's just kind of the surveillance mechanism. The trial was, the primary endpoints were death, stroke, and unplanned rehospitalization. And those are pretty standard now in valve therapy and heart failure trials, because we believe those are the three things that are most critical. Patients don't want to die. They certainly don't want to have a stroke, but they don't want to have an unplanned hospitalization. Mm-hmm. And the thing that was, you know, there was a couple things that were super stunning about this trial. The first was one in five patients couldn't pass a stress test. That was new information. I actually thought the number of people that would fail a stress test was actually going to be higher. So they're turning around, 80% could pass a stress test. But these patients were cardiovascularly very healthy. They had one of the scores we use to measure quality of life, how well someone is doing, is called the KCCQ score. And it's a validated developed score, and it goes from 0 to 100. 0 is basically, you know, you're dead. And 100 means you feel perfect in mm-hmm. simple terms. And these patients had KCCQ scores in the 90s, which is incredibly high. So these people felt like really close to perfect. Mm-hmm. And cardiovascularly, their heart was in good shape. Their heart was pumping very healthy. And so if there was any population of patients that should have been able to have a long progression, it should have been this group of patients, because they felt great and their hearts were healthy. What was stunning about this trial was the primary endpoint showed a demonstrative difference between early treatment and clinical surveillance. I think the clinical surveillance arm had at 2 years was in the 30s, 31 or 32% of the patients did the primary endpoint, and I want to say it was 51 in the control group. So there, we didn't see a big difference in death, which I can talk about. We did see a pretty significant numerical difference on stroke, but where the trial was really different was on rehospitalization. And what we found was even this very healthy group of patients progressed very, very quickly to symptoms. And of the patients that moved forward to symptoms, about half of those had what we would consider to be a pretty serious event. They ended up in the hospital. They ended up with an episode of syncope, you know, fainting, losing consciousness. They had something very serious happen to them. And that was happening before 6 months. 26% of the patients had one of these events happen within the first 6 months. And nobody would come back to their doctor in less than 6 months for a follow-up visit. So that means these patients wouldn't have been covered by current guidelines, which was a massive finding. We saw that almost half of the patients had crossed over in a year and ended up getting a valve replaced, because once you have symptoms, you're indicated for a valve. Now, one of the things people have talked about is, why didn't we see a mortality difference? If waiting is bad, why didn't we see that? And I think the biggest reason for that is we didn't allow the people to die. Everybody that entered this trial knew about their disease. They knew that they were eligible for a transcatheter heart valve therapy. They'd already met with their physicians and had consented to the procedure, which they had to do at time of randomization. But they had already had their CT, so they knew they were anatomically suitable. So when a patient showed up with symptoms or rehospitalized in the control arm, in the clinical surveillance arm, they were able to get treatment in about 30 days. In the real world, from the time a patient gets diagnosed with the disease, it can take 160 to 180 days. So as bad as clinical surveillance looked, this is the best clinical surveillance could ever look, because the patients were able to cross over and get life-saving therapy so quickly. Mm-hmm. But even with that, the trial was massively positive for early therapy.
Where do we go from here with this information? Is this something that is brought to physicians next? Is the physician community buying into these results? Do you go to insurers? I'm sure they're going to have a say in this. What's next with this information?
Well, the good news is this was an FDA IDE trial. It had a CEC, a DSMB, you know, all of the bells and whistles to ensure that this is the highest quality level one evidence. And so the trial, I think there's just not a lot that people can criticize the trial about. And I think that that's really important. It's also a large trial. It's 900 patients, which is pretty sizable in our space. The trial results were just presented about a month ago. And so I think now, in some ways, the real work starts. We have to start, how do we change the guidelines? We actually need to submit the data to FDA and get the FDA approval to expand the labeled indication. We need to work with CMS to ensure that the national coverage decision is updated so that all patients that are asymptomatic are eligible to receive this therapy and it'll be covered by Medicare. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done now. And then just the education itself. You know, we're changing 60 years of historical thinking. That's going to require a lot of education. It's going to require a lot of energy at the American Heart Association, the American College of Cardiology, the society, the surgical societies. We're really going to have to go out and drive this message out to certainly the general cardiologist, but probably even the general practitioners, so that they know it's not benign having severe aortic stenosis and we should not be waiting for symptoms. But the other real value point is it streamlines the care for patients, because now it can be as simple as if your echocardiogram says you have the disease, you should progress immediately to a heart team to be evaluated for a procedure, rather than going on this off-ramp that says we have to ascertain your symptoms. Are the symptoms a result of your AS? Should we be doing something else? A lot of patients get lost in the process in that off-ramp, and we can take that off-ramp out of their care pathway.
And you brought in the cancer comparison a few times. You don't wait for stage four treatment. Is this sort of a new paradigm for a medical device like this, where typically you're seen as a repair, something that's fixing a problem, something that broke? This is more healthcare. This is more, I think, treatment. This is more take the statin kind of preventative treatment. It seems to me. Is this a huge paradigm shift for a medical device company?
I think it is a paradigm shift, but it's important to remember these patients were asymptomatic, but they still had the severe disease.
Right.
They still had severe disease. So they were still, you know, using the analogy, class four lung cancer patients. They just were still breathing okay. So I think the next step in this process is, should we be waiting for stage four? And that's the next trial that we have, which is called PROGRESS, where we're going to go evaluate whether we should be waiting for severe disease. But early TAVR, everyone still had severe disease. They were just waiting till they felt bad.
Interesting. And final question about this study. Compared to the first TAVR study that we talked about in the previous podcast, I know you had mentioned that was a particularly difficult study where if someone was in the control group and they weren't doing well, because the study is what it is, you can't transition over to get any care. Was this a, this feels like a different type of study for you, one that's more hopeful and more really, I think, progressive in treating this disease. And they both were. But this, for you, was this a difficult trial to be in charge of emotionally?
No, emotionally, this trial was very easy to be in charge of. And this trial was very easy to be in charge of because patients in this trial got better care than patients that were out on the street. And the first trial that was so difficult, it's because we didn't know if the therapy would work. And so they held us to a very high standard that said it had to show a definitive patient benefit. But here, the minute a patient got symptomatic, we could immediately cross them over for therapy. And they got crossed over faster with probably higher quality care than if they were just your average person on the street. So this was a trial that you felt wonderful running because you knew everybody was going to get the best care possible. And that no one was going to be denied care because they'd already been pre-screened. So this was an easy trial to run emotionally. And it was a trial that I think all of us were super proud to be a part of.
Final question I've asked your colleagues about just more broadly. The focus of Edwards Life Sciences, when we last talked, critical therapies was, critical care was still part of the company. Obviously, there's a tighter focus now on structural heart. How has that changed what you do, or has it changed what you do? What do you see next for Edwards?
I wouldn't say it changed what my teams do very much. You know, we've always been focused on structural heart and on heart valves and doing all those things. I think the biggest changes that we're going through now are all the original partner trials were about, is it better to do surgery or is it better to do transcatheter heart valves? Mm-hmm. The disease was the disease, and it was just which therapy is better and how do the therapies compare? Now we're attacking, how do we fundamentally treat this disease? Should we be waiting for symptoms? It's not about surgery versus TAVR anymore. It's about the disease and how do we attack it? And the next trial we're doing, PROGRESS, is about moderate aortic stenosis. And it really is, should we be moving upstream and attacking the disease in an earlier point and preventing patients from declining? And so, you know, we're having the ability to address unmet needs and previously not understood aspects of structural heart and saying what would be the best therapy. And, you know, and that's true of the work that's being done in our TMTT group as well. You know, we're treating patients with tricuspid valves that would have not otherwise gotten any therapy. And so we're just really attacking the disease in a different way now. And so I feel like we're in a very different phase of our structural heart evolution now. We're moving into a disease state rather than just a device-to-device state.
Amazing. Great. Well, it's a great MedTech story. And Larry, thank you for sharing it and for joining us on the podcast.
Oh, my pleasure. It's always great to talk to you, and I appreciate your time and interest in our space.
All right, well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of the Structural Heart Talks podcast. Thanks, of course, to Confluent Medical for sponsoring this episode and for Larry Wood for making himself available. If you'd like to get future episodes of this and other podcasts, subscribe to the Device Talks Podcast Network. We're putting out many great MedTech podcasts. You won't want to miss any of them, so subscribe on any major podcast player to the Device Talks Podcast Network. Also, please connect with me on LinkedIn. I'd love to be part of your future MedTech conversations. And of course, connect to Device Talks and Managing Editor Kayleen Brown as well. And while you're on LinkedIn, share this episode so other folks can enjoy it. That's it, folks. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of the Structural Heart Talks podcast.